we're dealing with this very long-term complicated problem with short-term volatile policies, and that's just a recipe for disaster.
A very big welcome to this episode of Front Footing the Future. I'm Lindsay Wood, the Director of Climate Strategy Company Resilience Limited, and I'll be your host for interviewing about 20 experts ahead of the New Zealand general election and exploring how we can make our climate policy fit for purpose. Economist Shamabile Yacob was an easy choice to invite into our Front Footing the Future series. I've long admired his incisive ability to integrate economic issues with the likes of social and environmental imperatives. And when I researched further for this interview, such as reading the authoritative Ellen Clark Foundation report on social cohesion, and Shamabile was a co-author of that, I found so much more that resonated with me that I'll need to be careful this conversation doesn't run for 2 or 3 hours. Shamabile, it's such a delight to welcome you to Climate Matters, and I'm really looking forward to our conversation.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Maybe I could just start with a pretty open question by inviting you to discuss what's currently the most pressing climate-related issue in your mind and how you'd like to see that manifest itself in some sort of good policy.
I think fundamentally, we don't have a climate knowledge problem. There is a lot of knowledge that already exists. What we have is a problem of making the right choices when it comes to the climate. We keep on choosing to defer those choices, mainly because there are no painless choices. There will be some trade-offs that are required, some pain that's required to be shared, and gains that are required to be shared. To me, it feels like we think about climate as this separate thing rather than a more fundamental definition of the problem that we face in society, which is we have all the tools at our disposal, but we are unable to overcome those individual pressures to make those decisions.
Yes, I can relate to that. Building on that then, if we were to have a policy setting or maybe an attitude towards policy setting, how would you see that flowing from what you were just saying, Shamabile?
Yeah, I guess firstly, I think it's the framing of it. And I think there are two kind of aspects. One is that adaptation aspect, because I think we are already dealing with climate change today. And adaptation is something that we need to deal with today. And the second thing is that just transition aspect, because I think we do have to transition to doing things differently in the future. And in that process, we have to figure out who pays, who's protected, and how we get that balance right. And to do that from a policy perspective, again, good policy is not so much about the specifics of the policy, but how we make those policies. Because I think what I can see in terms of climate change policy, it's more like a relay race rather than a sprint. So the sprints are perhaps the election terms, the electoral cycles.
Yes,
and between those periods, we have to pass the baton on so that we have policies that are durable, that are predictable, and continue to be redistributive. Otherwise, what happens is we're dealing with this very long-term complicated problem with short-term volatile policies. And that's just a recipe for disaster. So to my mind, it's less about the specifics of the policy and that we haven't agreed on a broad enough suite of policies that we can stick with over a long period of time.
Yes, thank you for that. And in fact, that comes back to the whole business of multilateral or cross-party agreements and so on, which we've taken a step into that space and then seem to have retreated from a bit, don't we? So hopefully we can get back into that again.
I think it's entirely possible that we'll get back to it, but I have a little frustration that we are relying on politicians to come up with the solution and to provide that endurance, rather than recognizing that actually that endurance needs to come from the public. So a lot of the reasons why we see the politics being so volatile is because the politicians can see that it's a way to divide and conquer their population and win the next election. So I don't think we can always point the finger and say the politicians are the problem and the politicians are the solution, when actually it's us who haven't got a consensus in terms of what we want to do with climate change.
Thank you. That's a super perspective, and thank you for adding it to what we were talking about. And in a way, it gives me a good segue into the next topic I'd like to pick up on. In the introduction, I mentioned the social cohesion report that you were involved with at the Helen Clark Foundation. Although that report didn't expressly address this issue, it included relevant references to the benefits of social cohesion, such as a greater ability of citizens to take longer-term views, which obviously we think is important, or to participate in democratic processes. What do you see as the relevance of social cohesion in terms of formulating and implementing good climate policy? And I think that builds on what you were just saying.
It does. So social cohesion, in my mind, is not that we don't have differences within society, but that we can meet across difference. We can hold those differences. We are willing to change our minds when we share our worries and hopes and dreams with each other. And then we're able to kind of navigate that complexity together. And it's the together part. It's working together to a common purpose. That's what social cohesion looks like. And so until we kind of think, until we kind of have enough social cohesion, it's really hard for us to be able to deal with those big issues, whether it's climate change, whether it's aging, whether responding to geopolitics. It's more often than not, our ability to navigate those challenges together is the way that we create that endurance in policymaking. So going back to my kind of earlier analogy, if you think about those long-term policymaking, particularly around climate, as more like a relay race, then social cohesion is the bit that allows us to stay consistent between electoral cycles. Without social cohesion, what we find is there is no common base to what policies and regulations we pursue. They just go flip-flop, flip-flop over time. And I think that's really where we're finding most of the problems. And quite a lot of the challenges we see with social cohesion in New Zealand and around the world is to do with two things. One is what we've become a very individualistic society. So we see our place in society as individuals and individual material comforts, which of course matter, but we've kind of lost a little bit of the connection around the wider public and common good. And both of those things are actually really important for us to have good societies. So social cohesion kind of overlaps across all of those different ideas.
Yes, I love that. And I'm going to jump into a topic area which I had thought to come to a bit later. And that's the role of deliberative democracy in our society, citizens' assemblies, and so on, because you talked about being open to other points of view and then trying to reach a cohesive view together. Have you got any strong views on those as possible avenues for the future, Shamabil?
Absolutely. So I think what's really beautiful about something like a deliberative model is it moves away from what we do currently, which is vote, consult, and consume. So it's a very linear transactional thing. Whereas with a deliberative approach, we kind of make those citizens expert citizens for a while. They are furnished with the expert insight. They're given the time and the space to deliberate and contemplate, which we very rarely get to do on with depth and expertise and support. And I think that's that difference between, I think, being a citizen who votes, which I think is almost like the fast food version of citizenship, versus a citizen who's able to contemplate, be really understand the issues, and then work together with your fellow citizens to reach a solution that's good enough for everyone. And I think there are some real benefits to that. I don't think we need to use deliberative approaches for everything. But when it comes to those big issues, we can do a good job. And there are some examples of this, right? What happened in terms of that approach in South Dunedin, what they have done in Westport. None of them are perfect, but by God, that's a hell of a lot better than people just flinging, arguments against each other.
I'm totally with you. And it seems to me that there's a popular misunderstanding that it's just a sort of consultation on steroids, but the word deliberative is a very important part of that process, isn't it?
Absolutely. And I think, again, let's not be too optimistic about it in that even in a deliberative democracy model, quite often it's going to be the people with the most resources who participate, unless we take a very deliberate approach to make sure we get that cross-section of society there. So there is no perfect model, but you're absolutely right. The real thing is to have, how do we give people the capacity and standing to be able to deliberate? And so deliberative democracy, when done well, is extraordinarily powerful.
Thank you for that. I know it's surfaced as well as some examples such as the ones you mentioned, and Porirua comes to mind as well. It was also recommended in the Review of Local Government a couple of years ago. But as I've encountered resistance within councils to going down that track, almost like there's a feeling that the councils are disowning the faith that's been put in them by the electorate. Do you have any thoughts on how deliberative democracy processes can be made appealing to local government? And I say local government, it doesn't that just have to be that. And in particular, I'm thinking that there's a dichotomy of whether the Citizens' Assembly, say, has a right of decision or just a right of recommendation, and that tends to be a little bit of a point of controversy. Do you have any views on that?
Yeah, I do. I won't say it's a very good view, but the way I think about it is currently our local government and government engage in what I'd call consultation. And it's a consultation of convenience. So what we get is those who are disproportionately already advantaged, who are time rich, confident, system literate, they're the civic makers who get that influence and input into decision making. And because we don't recognize that, we think that consultation gives us a deliberative or good democratic outcome. And so unless you recognize that the current model of democracy is in fact not democratic, you won't see the benefit of a deliberative democratic process. Because a deliberative process is more expensive, it is slow. That's the benefit. If you're not slow, and if you're not taking people with you, if you're not having conflict that you mediate through the process, there is no value in it. And so I think a lot of the resistance comes from that, I think almost a pragmatic kind of laziness that says, I only have 3 years. I want to get this stuff done. I'd rather take a process that gives me the convenience of getting things done quickly and keeps the squeaky wheels happy.
Yeah, so it sort of ticks the box a bit, doesn't it, without necessarily achieving the result.
Well, I mean, we've seen this in so many processes in over the years, right? If you think back to the Auckland Unitary Plan, QCs at the time were highly represented in the number of people who made submissions. Poor people living in South Auckland did not. And it does not mean that those people were not equally affected or even more so affected by those processes. So, we have to kind of exercise our democratic duties with, I think, deliberation and consideration. And I don't see it often enough. I think there is a real laziness to the way we do it with real costs. That's the reason why people don't trust systems of government as much anymore. That's the reason why people are disengaging from local government because they think, what's the point?
Wouldn't it be lovely to reverse that trend? Just one little comment to pick up. You talked about deliberative democracy being expensive. I've been encouraging our local councils, I'm in the Nelson region, to treat it as an investment, not a cost, because I think it's an investment. If you apply it to the right topics, it's an investment in getting good decisions.
I don't disagree with you. I think you're absolutely right that there is an upfront cost to these things, and it is quite rightly an investment because you're more likely to get results that endure over time because you've taken so many people with you, because it's representative, because you've worked on the kinks of all those issues that you might experience. So you're right in that it can do that. But it's also that, like I said before, I think good citizenship is not really about voting and consuming. It's actually about being part of a community and building a better community together. And I think our current method of doing politics is very much in that consuming fast food model rather than that longer term constructive together model.
Right. Thank you. As I said at the beginning, I think we could talk for hours on a lot of these topics, but I better move us on, Shamabile, into a further area which I know you've been involved with, and that's the question of income inequality. And I'm very interested in that. And I was really delighted when I was reading the Social Cohesion Report that that referenced Wilkinson and Pickett, the spirit level, which to me is quite a touchstone of a research model. I'm not steeped in that area, but I think they make some very good points. Are you in a position to outline for listeners the core tenets of that work and where New Zealand sits in that context?
Sure. I mean, The Spirit Level is not a perfect book. No book is perfect. No research is perfect. But I think it has some pretty simple lessons that resonate very strongly with me. And what it says is that inequality makes us sicker, makes us more anxious, and less able to trust each other. So when it comes to this topic that we're talking about today, which is climate, it's actually not a side issue. It's the foundation. So if you have people who are sick and anxious and unable to trust each other, how are you going to agree on a set of policies and actions that will have winners and losers?
Totally. One of the findings that struck me out of the book, The Spirit Level, was that often the better off people were actually happier in a society that was less unequal from an income point of view. Am I reading that correctly there? Is that your understanding of it?
Generally speaking, when you've got less inequality, everybody is happier. So I think there is an element of that relative poverty that has quite a big impact.
Thank you for that. I want to take a big sideways step now into energy and the economy, because I know it's lovely for me to be talking to someone who's in the economics field, because I've spent quite a lot of time in the technical side, not energy directly, but it's lovely to join the two viewpoints. There's a long-standing but little discussed view that we actually run an energy economy, not a monetary one, and that energy is not a derived demand, as it's often referenced, but is actually something that shapes our society. If we take that further, and I'm going to get a little bit technical, the parameters of renewable energy, two of them that are problematic are A, it's high energy cost as a portion of the energy we get, and B, the fact that we still need a fossil fuel industry to develop its infrastructure, at least as far as we do now. And therefore, we might struggle to actually sustain an economy with our renewable energy. Do you have views on that, Shamabil?
Yeah, probably less linear than how you might have outlined it. So I think I'll grant you the point that economics does treat energy as an input, but not as a limit. And I think it can be both of those things, right? There are serious biophysical limits, and we need to think about how we take both of those into account. But I would push back against kind of thinking about it as an inevitable collapse. You know, that limits to growth, peak oil kind of idea. Those are kind of, we've had those conversations in the past. And the reason I push back is because we have seen real evidence that we can become more efficient, we can substitute, we can innovate. And, you know, our energy intensity in the economy has fallen for a number of decades. So it's still not enough, but we're making progress. So even in New Zealand, you know, as you see that our transport system is still very fossil fuel intensive. But our electricity system is actually quite light in terms of fossil fuels. So I think we have made progress in certain areas. So I don't know if I kind of buy into the idea that everything is limited and that it's static. I think it is possible to make progress, and a lot of the progress in terms of prosperity is not just about more inputs. It's also about us getting better. And I think if we think that we're going to get richer by just throwing more inputs at it, that I will concede is not likely. But in terms of our ability to get smarter, more efficient, to be able to substitute into other ways of doing things, I'd like to hope that we're still able to do that.
Thank you. Well, that's another debate we could roll on for a long time.
Can we add something on,
Oh,
Lindsay? Because I
yes.
think to me, the question isn't really about if growth ends, because it's almost the wrong question. I think it's about whether we can ensure there is enough prosperity and opportunity for people. But more importantly, whether the transition is going to be disorderly. I think therein lies the big risk, right? If we kind of go that all the costs of this transition to a different energy system is going to be borne by poor people, then I think we're going to destroy the fabric of society and create massive problems in the future. And so it's really about the transition and how we make sure we do that well in a way that those who contribute the least are not hurt. Those who contribute the most to the problems of energy consumption, emissions, that they pay their fair share.
Yeah, that's fair enough, I think, Chamabil. And one of the things there, I think, is you touched on transport a minute ago, and transport, of course, is a major part of our energy consumption. I've enjoyed interacting with some of your reports previously when I've given talks on carbon and building and that sort of thing, and I've piggybacked on some of yours, which were housing and transport. What sort of policy settings do you feel a government should really be targeting in order to get our built environment, and I'm meaning across the buildings and the transport infrastructure, to get our built environment sort of climate responsible and as future-proof as we might make it?
Yeah, look, I think the starting point is we treat housing, transport, and climate as three different issues, but they're not. They're clearly part of one system. And, if we can build the right cities, then we kind of deal with three of those problems all at the same time. And so the answer is, and this has become very dogmatic, ideological, the answer actually is compact and well-connected cities that will reduce our transport emissions, lower our housing costs. And we can, build the density that supports public transport, because we can't have lots of sprawl, lots of cars, and hope that somehow emissions are going to fall. It's just not going to happen.
No, it's an oxymoron almost, isn't it, in that context? And I'm totally agree with you. And I, as I said, I've been pleased to reference your work in that area in the past. We're in an election year, Shamabeel, and I don't know whether you want to go into the political space at all, but I've picked up in researching for this that you described both the 2023 budget and this year's one as typical election year budgets. Yeah. I think you used the term meat and veg, which I rather like. And you also made observations that struck me that the good times are always spoken of as just around the corner, and that big infrastructure promises often end up being unfulfilled. I thought they were pretty sobering sort of perspectives. Plus, the Social Cohesion Report found that UK initiatives were too focused on capital works and insufficiently on building community strength. If you were tasked with writing a manifesto for responsible social and climate policies in New Zealand, what sort of things would you like to see in it? What would it look like?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right in that our budgets and election manifestos are very focused on one, winning the election, and two, doing as much as they can in the 3 year period. But policies that require multiple political terms are very rarely given that thought and support to do that well. So if I were given that opportunity kind of to work on these kinds of things, I think the focus would be not necessarily on the what, but the how. How would we have ways of making decisions on issues that allows us to do things differently? And so that might be to do with whether we have independent organizations like commissions or more transparency, more accountability mechanisms, multi-year funding commitments. So it has to be kind of almost tricking the system to think beyond the political cycle. And I say that very deliberately because I want the power of democracy to make sure that we're making good decisions. But I also resent the fact that everything is stuck in a 3 year loop where not every decision can be made in that time.
I'm totally with
So
you.
if you want to move beyond that, we have to kind of do something. And I'm not quite sure because it doesn't, I'm not entirely sure what that looks like. But I think a lot of it's to do with making sure that we are spending money in ways that are different. Building ways of doing government that are different, not always about spending and regulating, but also about being convening powers, of being people who kind of create those processes of deliberation. And that's a real difficulty for politicians because they don't want to let go of that power.
I agree. They want that. They're rather concerned that a deliberative process might not land where they want it to land, and then they've got to push through something that they don't altogether believe in.
It's that idea of perseverance, right? Like there are so many of these ideas, particularly around those big policies, whether it's around energy or climate or housing, you can't have things that just go stop start. And I don't think we should be super negative because it is possible for us to make good decisions. So if you look at our history, we have done that in the past. So I look at, for example, what we did in our housing policy post the Second World War. Through multiple changes of government, we did some pretty amazing stuff in New Zealand. When you look at the progress we've made in housing policy in New Zealand in the last 10 to 15 years, also very impressive. And through multiple changes of government, not perfect, but heading in the right direction. So I think we also need to understand that once we stop fighting about whether there is a problem and we're fighting about the solutions, it may not be consistent, but progress can be made. So it is possible for us to have perseverance. It is possible for us to do good things. But I think the conversation needs to shift from fighting about the problems to fighting about the solutions.
Yes, I agree with you, and I'm pleased you've mentioned perseverance because I picked that up out of one of your reports, and I've got a little personal story to tell about perseverance. Many years ago, I had quite a lot to do with Hamburg in northern Germany, and I had the chance to meet the sustainability manager at Hamburg Airport. Udo Bradison was his name, and he met me in the concourse, and he said, and here was me thinking I was going on a tour, and he said, "Come and have a coffee." And he sat me down for a coffee and he said, "First word, perseverance." And then he said, "The second word is CEO buy-in," in that order. And he'd had a lot of experience around the world that was it exactly resonated with what you said. Maybe I should have picked this up a little earlier when we were talking about income inequality, but and I don't want this to be too politically specific, but I'm interested that the Opportunity Party has put out a form of universal basic income. They haven't called it that. I think citizens' wage or something is what they've called it. But that is also, I see, you've mentioned a couple of times we need to try and do things differently. Do you have a view on the role that might play, Shamabil?
Yeah, look, I'm not going to tell you who to vote for, but
No,
I
of
guess
course.
things like a guarantee, things like a guaranteed income and a land tax, those are very serious attempts to go, how can we give more people more security and incentives to think long term? And I think that's the connection with how we kind of create that game, that long-term game for climate change. The challenge with these policies, of course, is that something like a UBI and a land tax both run against a pretty strong incumbency. The people who are currently not paying very much tax obviously don't want to do that. Because you need to have a very high tax revenue to be able to pay for it, and the fact that people who currently don't pay much tax suddenly will have to pay a lot of tax means that politically it's very unlikely to be implemented in the near future. And that's the reason why I don't engage with those two topics particularly much, because I just don't think it's going to happen in the near future.
So that's not a saying they're not a good idea. It's just the realities of how we get them across the line. Is that more?
Totally. I mean, we already have tools that are pretty good. Like, if I had my way, we would absolutely have a tax on capital, and land makes a lot of sense because it's a capital that can't run away. But a wealth tax of some sort would be really useful because that would mean that our tax burden is shared more equally to those who can afford it. I would like to see our welfare system becoming more generous, more supportive of helping people move out of poverty, which it currently doesn't do. And also, we talked about earlier before, I think in passing, that we see that in citizenship, in democracy, it's those with resources who participate the most. But we want to make sure that everybody has enough resources to both to invest in themselves individually, but also to invest in their citizenship, which is including in voting and participating in deliberative approaches and all those other bits and pieces. And so currently our system is not doing that. And so we know there is a problem with our tax system, our welfare system, our wider system, but how do we get there? That bit is not clear to me.
No, it's getting from here to there that's half the problem sometimes, isn't it?
Well, it is. I mean, we do have to grapple with these issues, but we also know that in New Zealand, our history shows we will only grapple with them when there is a crisis of a very large proportion.
Yes, and one that we recognize, and probably a quick crisis because we've got a slow climate crisis that I think the pace of it is one of the things that rather hoodwinks people, isn't it?
Well, I think it did, but when I've been doing a lot of work in insurance, and what's very clear is it's no longer a slow moving and a small thing anymore. It is a fast moving, large cost. I look at our insurance, reinsurance costs, for example. They used to be something like 0.1% of GDP. Now they're close to 1% of GDP. That's a tenfold increase in the cost of getting insurance. That's because those reinsurers can see that we are risky. So climate change is not a problem of the future. It's here today. And I think the insurance sector is going to force many of those conversations, because if we don't have them, we're going to lose coverage. We're going to create ghettos where poor people live because there is no insurance. And that is not a New Zealand I want to see.
No, I'm totally with you on that. And the insurance company, I think they're realistic and their actuaries are switched on enough to to send the warning signals that a lot of other people have been slow to pick up, aren't they?
Well, I think they've also been quite reactive. So let's not give them too much credit. They're human just like us. So if you look at when the costs increase, it's after every disaster. So after Canterbury, they suddenly realize that earthquake is a peril that needs to be priced. After the floods, after the storms, each time they have added new perils. So no, I think, they're human just like us, but they send a very strong binding signal that if you want to transfer your risk, the cost of transferring that risk is very high. And very soon, I think already it would be cheaper for us to try and create those investments in adaptation and managing and reducing those risks rather than looking to transfer those risks.
I'm totally with you. And in fact, I was framing a question in my mind as you started to say that, because you mentioned a moment ago that the reinsurance costs were sitting at somewhere around about 1%. And in my reading and so on, quite often a figure of 2% of GDP is put out as the sort of figure we should invest in climate responses to expect to turn the tide a bit on it. Now, I dare say that figure's getting higher as we leave it unattended, but do you have any comments on that regard?
Yeah, well, I think it's less about the quantum of money. I think everybody thinks it's additional investment, but I think it's the way we invest. We can't make stupid decisions and build on floodplains and, next to places that are prone to erosion and all those other bits and pieces. So we already have enough knowledge. So I think there is an element of knowledge that's important that we keep on investing in so we understand the risks and the perils that insurers talk about. And the second part is as we invest, as we renew, we have to make really strong decisions in terms of what we keep, what we maintain, and what we stop. So, we can't just be blind to this was built 100 years ago and we must keep it because some things we have to kind of move on from. So, a lot of it, I think, is not necessarily that we need to throw more money at it, but I think we do need to think about it in terms of how do we make sure the investments we do make take climate change into consideration. So, in my mind, climate change is not a vertical, it's not a line item. It's something that should run across every decision that we make.
I'm totally with you. It permeates the whole field, and you only have to spend 5 minutes studying climate issues to realize everything's connected, don't you? Shamabeel, I could keep talking, but I would like, before we get completely to the end, I'd like to just give you the chance to, if there's anything else that you think, oh, I'd really like to put this out there to the listeners. So I'd be very interested to hear if you had anything else on mind.
Sure. Look, I think partly it's about how do we find optimism and hope? Because so many of the conversation around climate change, social cohesion, inequality, they feel intractable and impossible to resolve. And yet, I would say that I'm not a doomer in the sense that I think there is reasons for optimism, particularly in a country like New Zealand. So the reason I do work on social cohesion and not because I want to find what the problems are, but because I want to know how to bring back the cohesion that we did have. So when I look at those problems we talked about before, like the post-war state housing program, the near fully renewable electricity network that we already have the capacity. It's proven in our history. It's in our DNA. So the constraint is actually choice rather than capacity. So to me, it's a little bit more of a civic call. So, when we think about climate, housing, inequality, they're all the same problems with different hats, right? It's all about the underlying thing in terms of are we able to come together to share some costs so then we can share future benefits? And I think that's really where all of this sits is we have to be able to bear a little bit of cost, some of the upfront investment that's required for those long-term benefits. Because, our generations have really reaped the benefits of what past generations have done. It's now our turn to pay it forward.
Yes, I agree with you. And right at the beginning, you made the reference that it was a bit like a relay race and not a sprint. And you were talking about the baton being passed from one term of parliament to another. But at the same time, it went through my mind that you could say the relay is from one generation to another, too, couldn't you? And in that sense, what you were just saying is exactly in that space.
Totally. I think, that intergenerational equity, we want to leave our children and grandchildren better off as our parents and grandparents wanted for us. So I think it's only fair and right that we don't sit here and extract and destroy things for future generations because that's just not right.
Shamabeel, I think we'll call it to a close now. That's been wonderful talking with you. You've we've made good progress on what was quite a long list of topics I put out in front of you. So thank you so much for joining us. I've enjoyed it very much. As I said, I think we could keep talking for hours if we had time, but we don't have that sort of time.
Nobody's going to listen to us talk for that long.
No, you a bit of realism coming in there. Thanks very much, and look forward to having contact another
Thanks
time.
very much. Have a great day.
Well, more insightful comments from a wonderfully equipped guest. Aren't we lucky to have someone like Shamabeel on the show? I loved it how he tied his comments into a range of social policies and social involvement in decisions and so on. Be great if some of his ideas appeared in climate policy. Next week's guest is Miriana Stevens. Miriana Wakapapa's Te Ngāti Rangi, Te Ngāti Ranganui, and Te Ngāti Rārua, and she brings a wealth of business experience strongly blended with Te Ao Māori and a sustainability ethos. And then following that, we have Victoria Mulligan. Victoria is a professional futurist, a certified foresight practitioner, and brings us great ways of envisaging the future. Following that will be Dr. Catherine Knight, who has recently spearheaded the Reality of Everything Symposium. So I do hope I have you in company for those interviews, and of course, kia kaha for the climate.
This podcast was brought to you by Fresh FM with assistance from New Zealand On Air. Other great local podcasts are available through our website, freshfm.co.nz.